The America's Quarterly Podcast is sponsored by the Boeing Company. Last October, the global aviation industry came together around a pretty audacious goal to achieve net zero carbon emissions by the year 2050. About two-thirds of the reduction in emissions will need to come from a transition to sustainable fuels. That's an area in which Boeing has been working for years with partners in Brazil and elsewhere around Latin America, using substances like sugar and wood residue as fuels to ensure that the aviation of tomorrow is safe and sustainable. Welcome to the America's Quarterly Podcast. I'm Brian Winter. Peru's President Pedro Castillo is facing sinking approval ratings and the risk of impeachment, as well as a crisis in the mining sector. What explains the relatively quiet approach he's taken during his first 6 months in power?
He seems to be stuck between being more radical or being more moderate and finding that none of those are really working out for him. And so he's just stuck, right? Without making any sort of big decisions.
Pedro Castillo was an unknown to most of the world when he was elected Peru's president last year. A 52-year-old school teacher and former union leader with roots in rural Peru's indigenous communities, Castillo's rise in politics was so sudden that, famously, after the first round of voting when he placed first, CNN and Espanol didn't even have a photo of Castillo to show on TV on election night. We had our own version of this at America's Quarterly, by the way, where we profiled eight candidates over the course of the campaign. None of them were Pedro Castillo, but at least we weren't alone. And then we all watched last July as this man in his trademark hat took office, and we wondered, what will his five-year presidency really be about? Well, it's been 6 months since the inauguration, and we're still waiting for answers. Pedro Castillo's government has been marked, at least to some extent, by paralysis. I mean, it really has been quite unusual. He hasn't done that much. He hasn't said that much. He's had a falling out of sorts with his own party, the hard left Peru Libre. He's apparently not talking much with Peruvian business leaders or the press. The critical mining sector, keep in mind Peru is the world's number two producer of copper, an important producer of many other minerals as well, is plagued by uncertainty and labor strife. And there have already been some scandals. And as a result, perhaps inevitably, there is talk of possible impeachment of Castillo in a country where that fate has befallen several of the most recent presidents. So what explains this somewhat strange, uncertain start to the Castillo presidency? What can we expect going forward? And ultimately, can Peru break out of its recent slump and recapture the dynamism that made it one of Latin America's best performing economies in the 2000s and 2010s? To help us try to answer some of these questions, I'm joined by my friend Andrea Moncada. Andrea is a Peruvian political analyst and journalist who was previously the opinion editor at El Comercio, and she is now based in the UK. She has been one of the most astute observers of Peruvian politics over the last year and is a contributing columnist for America's Quarterly. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So, Andrea, before we get into the politics of this, I just want to ask a little bit about the state of things in Peru at the moment. Peru was one of the countries in the world, in fact, by some measures, the hardest hit country in the world by COVID-19. On a per capita basis, the death rate was the world's highest, according to several databases. It was also just devastated economically. GDP declined 11%. In 2020, that was one of the steepest declines anywhere in the world. Now, it has come roaring back in 2021 with growth of about 13% last year, according to the Peruvian Central Bank. And the forecast for 2022 is not bad. According to Fitch, 4.7% growth is expected. But look, I mean, these numbers, they tell us something but not everything, certainly not the full human story. Tell us, I mean, I know you're in the UK at the moment, but you, of course, you still have excellent sources, friends, family there on the ground in Peru. What's the mood there right now? Is there a sense that the worst is past, or is Omicron now kind of sweeping the country like it is everywhere else?
Well, it's certainly sweeping the country, but I was actually just recently back in Peru for a couple of weeks over the Christmas break. And the feeling that I get is that people are just trying to get on with their lives as much as they can, and that there is this sense that the worst is over. There's a bit more optimism in that regard, but not in respect to the country's situation in general.
This recovery that I described in kind of the headline economic numbers, I mean, look, GDP is notoriously imperfect at reflecting what the mood is for people. It doesn't tell us what's happening with poverty and unemployment. Did you get the sense that people are feeling part of this recovery yet, or does it still feel very uncertain?
I think it still feels rather uncertain. Uncertainty regarding what exactly is going to happen with the government, right? We all know Castillo is a very unstable figure. He has very weak leadership. He has basically no political allies except for perhaps some aspects of the more moderate left, because as we know, even his own party has sort of turned his back on him a bit. There's this feeling, I think, that people aren't quite sure whether things are going to go back to quote unquote normal, or if we're just going to expect more and more crises as the months go by. We've already seen plenty of scandals coming out, as you mentioned earlier.
So let's get into the politics. You heard kind of the comments that I made in the introduction. What explains this such an unusual beginning to this presidency where, you know, he got elected with a decent mandate? What has he done with it? Why has he been so quiet, I guess? I mean, what explains this very bizarre dynamic in Lima right now?
Yeah, honestly, if you think about it, if you think about the person that he is and his background and the way in which he managed to be elected, got into power, I don't think it's that bizarre at all. I think Castillo is someone who's found himself very serendipitously in a position of power, of huge power, and doesn't really know what to do with it. This has been, in a way, both good news and bad news, right? Good news in the sense that he's not turning out to be this radical leftist that's determined to nationalize all of Peru and has no regard for property rights, which is sort of like the image that the right had tried to make up, had tried to build up right after his election. And he also doesn't seem like this possible authoritarian dictator that wants to centralize power, wants to get rid of opposition. What he seems to me is a man who is far removed from, has always been far removed from the social mores of Lima's political elite. Someone who's lived all his life in Cajamarca in a fairly rural setting, who right now probably feels very out of water, who doesn't know who to trust. And so I think that sort of explains both the apparent paralysis that's coming out of the executive and also why he's surrounding himself with the people around him, right? With people who come from his hometown, who are part of the teachers union that he's also part of, called FENATE. And so I think he's probably this last 6 months now, he's been trying to figure out the scenario around him and has no idea what to do, most likely.
I mean, Andre, I've been following Latin American politics for more than 20 years now. And with these outsider candidates, especially, they come in and it takes them some time to figure out how power works, maybe for them to figure out like how to square their original platform against what's possible once they get into power. Usually that takes a couple months, but not 6 months. And I wonder if what makes the Pedro Castillo story unique is this very odd relationship that he has had with his own party, Peru Libre. Can you, for an audience that hasn't followed every chapter necessarily in that telenovela, can you walk us through how this started going back to the beginning when Pedro Castillo was somewhat unexpectedly selected as the candidate, the presidential candidate for this party.
Right. So to sort of understand how he got where he is, we have to understand first the history of the party, right? So Perú Libre is headed by Vladimir Cerrón. Vladimir Cerrón is this very radical Marxist politician, previously neurosurgeon, who was also for, two periods, governor of a region in Peru called Junín. And he built this political party around him, basically. And so the idea behind choosing Castillo as the party candidate in last year's presidential elections wasn't to really get to the highest office. It was basically to allow Perú Libre to have political representation in Congress. They needed to have more than 5% of the electorate of the votes to be able to have representatives in Congress, right? And Cerrón himself wasn't the candidate because he has a judicial sentence against him for corruption that inhabilitated him from participating in public life, basically. He can't hold any sort of public office anymore.
So he chooses Castillo, who had some national fame because of his leadership in this teacher's strike a few years before. But from everything I've been able to gather, and based on what you're saying as well, they did not think he would win.
No, I don't think Castillo himself thought he would win. I think it must have been the best day of Vladimir Cerrón's life when Pedro Castillo made it to the runoff. And not even in his wildest dreams, he probably thought that this would happen. And it really just happened because politics in Peru were so fragmented at that time that worked out in Castillo's and Cerrón's favor.
Yeah, he caught fire at the right time.
Yes.
And people were looking for an outsider. And then he ends up in the runoff against Keiko Fujimori, who people knew, but had, you know, one of Peru's most unpopular politicians, and then Castillo wins the runoff. But back to this dynamic between Castillo and Cerrón, because now Castillo wins the runoff, and immediately you start seeing these very public signs that Castillo and Cerrón are not on the same page.
Yes, I think that's explained because so Castillo had a very difficult choice to make, right? If he sided completely with Vladimir Cerrón, that would have meant that he would have had basically the entirety of the country against him. Pretty much every sector, except perhaps a small part of the electorate, right? So the business sector, the media, which is very aligned with right-wing groups and business groups, the right-wing opposition, which is the majority in Congress, right? He would have been up against pretty much something insurmountable, right? And so I think what he tried to do was to sort of toe a fine line between sort of listening and siding with Vladimir Cerrón. And that's why he chose, as we know, as we can remember, Guido Bellido as his prime minister originally, who was also very lined up with Cerrón. But then he also tried to incorporate more moderate aspects of the left, like Pedro Franque as finance minister and other figures from Veronica Mendoza's circle. She's the leader of Nuevo Peru, which is a more moderate leftist political party. I think he tried to toe that line, but I think that the way that Peruvian politics is structured right now, it just makes it impossible. He seems to be stuck between being more radical or being more moderate and finding that none of those are really working out for him. And so he's just stuck, right? Without making any sort of big decisions.
And some of the atmospherics around it has been, I used the word telenovela earlier. It is sometimes like watching a political thriller where at one point during that transition period between winning the ballotage and taking office, Castillo gets pulled into these meetings with Perú Libre and isn't seen in public for, as I recall, a couple of days. Then later on, when it becomes clear that he's going to either toe the line or walk a somewhat more moderate path, Cerrón starts tweeting attacks, as I recall, not often mentioning Castillo by name, but everybody knew what he was doing. I mean, he was basically expressing outrage over the fact that Castillo was not his either a puppet or ally, choose your term. And then, of course, Bellido, the prime minister, a quite radical figure, ends up getting ousted as well. So where does that leave us now? Is this the story? Has it been Castillo being pulled so violently in these two directions between this hard left that is confiscatory, Marxist in its origin, and a more moderate group that's still the left, right? I mean, it's a moderate left is represented by Veronica Mendoza, who you mentioned, who sort of represents this more moderate left in Peru. Is he getting pulled so hard in those two different directions that the end result ends up being that he is just not doing much of anything?
Yep. And I think we have to add in a third factor into this, which is that he is still a man with agency, right? He still probably has his own interests and his own perspective. And I think in that paralysis, what sort of won out has been just him trying to make the most of his situation for those around him, for himself, right? Because I think there's no other way of explaining all these scandals that have been coming out of the governmental palace, all these strange secret meetings with lobbyists who represent companies who then go on to very inexplicably winning concessions and on governmental projects, all these accusations of people around him, like, for example, his previous secretary general trying to pressure the military into favoring some officers or pressuring even the head of the tax office to favor certain companies, right? And so I think his paralysis has led him to choose people who he thinks he can trust, people closest to him, who then all have their own interests and agendas and are now actually being extremely traditional as far as Latin American politics go by looking at the state like a boon, a treasure chest, basically.
So, Andrea, this leads me to a question that I think is on the minds of ordinary Peruvians, of investors, both inside and outside Peru, which is maybe a government that is on a certain amount of autopilot is not necessarily the worst thing, because that's actually been the story in Peru for several years now. And one of the, you know, really unique things about Peru over the years has been that it's had this really tumultuous politics and a pretty good economy. I mean, sometimes a great economy. You know, this 13.2% growth in 2021, certainly not enough to repair all the damage done, especially, you know, for ordinary Peruvians, but still a brisk recovery, much better than some people expected. And this forecast for between 4 and 5% growth in 2022, which is better than most of Latin America will do, certainly looks great compared to countries like Brazil and even Colombia. So my question is that where we're headed back to? Is sort of a return to the Peruvian status quo with these politics that are not helping, but not necessarily hurting either, because they're so locked into their own business that the economy just kind of, you know, runs along?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty accurate way of putting it. But I would have to disagree with you on the fact that it's great for the economy, even though it's bad for politics, because I think the main tragedy that Peru has experienced over the last 20 years is that, sure, we've grown economically, but that hasn't really translated into a better quality of life for people, for ordinary people. And, you know, one of the starkest facts about the pandemic, or that came out rather during the pandemic, was that around 42% or 48% of Peruvians don't have refrigerators, which is such a basic thing, you know, when you think about it. It's a shocking thing to think about. And so, sure, I think we're going to still keep on going with the autopilot that we've been on. And probably in terms of large business, that's better. That's, you know, a better situation, a better outcome than the Venezuelan nightmares that people were having at the beginning of this government. But all that political fighting is just, it just means that there's not going to be a lot done when it comes to actually getting that growth, grabbing that growth and translating it into something better.
No, I agree, Andrea. And look, I mean, on the one hand, it is true that the Peruvian growth of the 2000s and 2010s caused poverty rates to fall quite a lot. And so it wasn't just GDP doing well. I mean, it had one of the best records of poverty reduction in Latin America during that time, but it was also, you know, within a model that failed to address informality, for example. I mean, you still have I think it's more than 70% of Peruvian laborers are outside the formal sector, which is actually well above the Latin American average. So certainly, I mean, this status quo that I describe, yes, is good for some people probably, but not so good for ordinary Peruvians.
Yeah, it's a shame. I mean, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with business and investment, and we need it. We depend on it. And I think Peru could do more to foster a better business climate, but we also need the people in charge to do something with that money, to do something with that growth.
So what do you think, Andrea, is going to happen to Pedro Castillo? Do you think that he will be impeached ultimately at the end of the day? What's the current handicap on that? I mean, it is such a, we cannot overstate how common impeachment has become in the kind of day-to-day Peruvian politics. I mean, it's almost banal at this point, right? Yeah. Do you think it's going to happen to him too?
So I am wary of making any big predictions because
I don't blame you.
in political science, that usually, you know, doesn't work in the predictor's favor. But I think it's still a very likely outcome. I do think, though, that right now, so before I would have told you that, yes, that's definitely going to happen and it's probably going to happen pretty soon. But now I think the balance is slightly in his favor. For instance, recent figures came out about his approval ratings. He's got 60% disapproval, which is very high compared to his predecessors around this time in their presidency, right? Even though he has a very high disapproval rating, Congress has a higher disapproval rating than he does. So for Peruvians, I think the logic right now is that it might be better to have a mediocre Castillo in power than to have some politician picked out by Congress running the country, or someone from, I don't know, Fuerza Popular or Renovación Popular, and these are not parties that are particularly popular, right? So I think maybe Peruvians will sort of accept that we're just stuck with this guy who doesn't really do it much of anything, and maybe the right will just wait until something very juicy and scandalous comes along, which in all likelihood it probably will happen, considering what's been happening in the past few months.
What's happening right now in the opposition space with, you know, the Fujimoristas, Keiko Fujimori, of course, being from the family. Her father was the president of Peru back in the 90s. And there's a whole, I mean, talk about a saga. There's a whole backstory to that one as well. But where is that group now? I mean, are the Fujimoris still kind of the main people in charge of the opposition, or is there a new group, and what are the dynamics like?
Yeah, no, I don't think they're the main party of the opposition anymore. Well, one, because for a very sort of simple reason, is that the president of Congress is not from Fuerza Popular. She's called Mari Carmen Alba, and she's from Acción Popular, which is a more centrist, right, political party that's been around for quite some time in Peruvian politics. But also, we've also seen sort of the emergence of the more radical aspects of the right, embodied in Rafael López Aliaga, who's the leader of Renovación Popular, and he's quite strident and tends to make a lot of noise, and so he tends to grab more of the media's attention than Fuerza Popular, right? And so I think the opposition is sort of split into these three groups: traditional Fujimoristas, more centrist, leaning more towards the right, Acción Popular, and Renovación Popular, which would be the more radical, more extreme version of the right.
So, Andrea, if they're divided like that, then they're probably not doing a very good job of pushing back against Castillo, right?
Right. They're not. They're not doing a very good job. They're also very unpopular, which takes the pressure off Castillo a little bit, right? Because if Peruvians don't like Castillo, they definitely do not like the opposition.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in the real economy while all this political intrigue transpires. The mining sector has been interesting. We've all read reports in the press about investments being frozen. There has been considerable labor strife and, as a result, paralysis at Las Bambas mine, which is it's owned by a Chinese company. What can you tell us about that sector in particular? What explains this uncertainty that we've seen there over the last couple months since Castillo came in, and maybe even before that?
So I think people felt when Castillo was elected that they would have a more sympathetic ear when it came to the sort of discontent and distrust around mining projects, right? We know that Peru has had several social conflicts around mining projects going back to even the early 2000s, right? And it's just been getting progressively worse, right? And now Las Bambas, I think, in particular, is the example, the illustration that even a more leftist-leaning government doesn't know how to handle or is not better equipped to handle social conflicts around mining projects.
What is the core of the dispute there?
Right. So it's been sort of latent since 2016. The main dispute is that there is a community in Cusco that is protesting a road that was built in 2016 to allow MMG to transport copper from Las Bambas to a seaport in the region of Arequipa, which is in the south. And so the community around this road argue that it is disrupting their livelihood, that it is causing pollution, that it is affecting their agriculture, which is basically what they rely on for subsistence, right? And they demand to improve the road and also to be included in the project's area of influence, right? So they want to directly benefit economically from whatever revenue the project makes.
So where is the Castillo government on this then? I mean, they're trying to mediate.
Yeah, so they've been negotiating and holding a lot of dialogue with the community and also with the company. They've been doing this since last year. Some sort of agreement was reached because communities then lifted the blockade of the road. But apparently that sort of broke apart again and they've started to block the road again. And very recently, just now, the government submitted a proposal to the community in which the company would be financially responsible for the community, but the community has rejected the proposal, saying that they want to be included in the area of influence, which would mean, I think, a bit more economic aid.
But it's all part, Andrea, of this regional debate that's happening right now about, you know, so-called extractivism and how much countries that are sitting on vast amounts of mineral wealth, whether it's crude oil or lithium or copper or hydrogen, really all up and down, particularly the Pacific coast of South America, there is a lot of debate around this right now. And you see it at the top of the agenda for Gabriel Boric, who was just elected president of Chile, Gustavo Petro, who's by some accounts the leading candidate in polls for Colombia's election this year. He's on the left, of course. But it was interesting, in a recent interview with Bloomberg, he split the region's leaders not into blocks of left and right, but kind of pro and anti-extractivism, which is to say this issue is extremely important to him. Where is this headed right now? Because Castillo seems like an example of a government that came in with at least some clear ideas and then found that it has so far been unable to mediate this dispute. And of course, there's the broader question, which is, okay, if you do without at least some of these revenues, where is your tax revenue going to come from? You know, what is the economic model of the country if you rely less, at least, upon some of this mineral wealth?
Yeah, I don't think Castillo's against extractivism. What Peru Libre wants, in particular, is to control the extraction of those natural resources, right? In order for the state to have most of the revenue. I would sort of compare Peru Libre and Castillo more to Evo Morales in that sense, right? This desire to control the revenue and the economic benefits, say, of resource extraction. The complaint that Peru Libre has put forth is that these mining companies and hydrocarbon companies don't pay enough taxes and that most of what they make from resource extraction should actually stay in Peru, right? But they're not against it. On the contrary, they just basically want to control the outcome of that extraction.
Finally, Andrea, how optimistic are you about at least some kind of stability being in place for ordinary Peruvians, for people investing there over the next 5-10 years? I mean, are we still in search of some kind of political equilibrium, or is there a chance that, as you kind of said, that society will reach some kind of accommodation with the Castillo government and whoever succeeds them, and life will kind of go on?
Yeah, I think we're probably going to stay on this autopilot course that we've talked about for the foreseeable future. I do not see this government being able of making any sort of change to the economic policies that have been put in place in Peru. I think, if anything, the inability of this government to govern is just going to further polarize Peruvians, right? I think it's just going to further bolster other more radical alternatives, not from the left, but from the right. I've always sort of felt that that is the bigger danger for Peru in the upcoming future. The economy, I think, is going to muddle along as it has for the past 20 years. In terms of politics and stability, I think the worst is actually yet to come. I hope I'm wrong. I'm not being very optimistic, clearly, but that's sort of my sense.
Well, Andrea, we'll see. It'll be interesting to watch. And wishing Peru the best. And thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the America's Quarterly podcast. You can read more at americasquarterly.org. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review and a rating, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast is produced in partnership with Human Group Media. Our producers are Benjamin Russell and Fernanda Uriegas. America's Quarterly is an independent, not-for-profit publication of America's Society and the Council of the Americas.